This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. Well, looking out our windows here at Studio 3, it's rainy, it's windy, but it's clearly much worse both on the coast and to the south of us. Meanwhile, the candidates are all laying low. We're expected to hear from President Obama later in the hour. We'll stand by on that. Meanwhile, if everything stays relatively calm overnight, the final debate between Senator Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren will be held tomorrow night right here at our WGBH studios. Dorchester native and CNN chief national correspondent John King is going to be moderating that debate, and he joins us now in Studio 3. Hey, John, welcome.
Welcome.
Glad you got into town.
I hope the weather gods support us and we get to have our debate.
I hope so, too. All right, also here in the studio is Glenn Johnson. He's the political editor for Boston.com and the author of the blog Political Intelligence, and Graham Wilson, chair of the Political Science Department at Boston University. So I think everybody is hoping this final debate happens tomorrow because the next night is Halloween. That's not going to work. Then Thursday gets a little close for comfort, I think, for the candidates to have a debate that close to Election Day.
Candidates like certainty. As you get closer to Election Day, they like to control their own messages, their advertising. And I think this storm, both in this Senate race, some other races in New England, and especially in the presidential race as well, it's a big question mark in an already uncertain and the new Globe poll out just minutes ago showing a dead heat race. So it's a consequential and important time in the race. It's a big debate for the two candidates. And it's we can't answer the question of how much impact the weather will have. You see early voting in some other states.
Was shut down.
Shut down today because of the weather. So New Englanders are used to a little wacky weather, though. It's okay.
All right, so let's talk about the poll just out. This just in, the Boston.com poll just released, shows Scott Brown with 45%, Warren with 43%. That changes and evens out when people who are leaning, you know, say who they're going to vote for. That comes out rather even at 47%. But this is a switch from polls we've seen over the last few weeks.
Yeah, well, just in September, it was 43-38, Warren over Brown. And now you're seeing an essentially tied race, and when you put in leaners, you know, even more of a tight race. So it's unclear, you know, what this movement is from. But, you know, I was up in Lowell yesterday, and I saw Scott Brown give a speech, and it was a group of people who were branding themselves Democrats for Brown, and there was over 500 people in that room.
We're just kind of somebody come in and take a look at your mic. We're picking you up off of somebody else.
But my memory is that you had a poll a couple of weeks ago that had Brown ahead.
Go ahead. We're just switching mics around.
So I think it has been changing backwards and forwards.
But this is it's a remarkable race in the sense that the Globe, that's new poll, also shows the presidential race getting a little closer. And one of the big dynamics for Brown here is, you know, how big is the Obama victory in Massachusetts? Because the bigger the Obama victory, the steeper the hill for Senator Brown. Just if you look back, if you look back nationally over the last 25 years, the correlation between presidential and Senate voting has changed significantly, and people are much more likely to stick if they vote one party for president to stick when they vote for Senate.
And so that's the conventional wisdom, and I've been saying right along. I think we're going to see huge crossover. We saw you know in 2010 with the Coakley race, and I think you're gonna see it again.
And in the poll too, you saw the president go from having a 27% lead in the September survey to just 14% now. So yeah, he's still comfortably ahead. I don't think anybody thinks he's going to lose Massachusetts, but it's that margin that's always been the basis for the Elizabeth Warren candidacy. That in a presidential year, turnout will be greater. That if there's a big vote for President Obama, it will break proportionally for her. And I think what I saw up in Lowell and what you've been feeling, Emily, is there's going to be a lot of people that are going to split the ticket. They may vote for President Obama at the top, but I think they're going to make a different judgment. One of them was Lowell Mayor Bud Caulfield, former city councilor, former mayor, 24 years up there, 55 years a Democrat, and he's coming out for Scott Brown. And I asked him, you know, what about, you know, Warren's statements about different votes that he's cast? And Bud doesn't care. He says Scott Brown's a good guy and he's a leader. And that really shows the permeation of this Brown campaign of personality.
Well, I wonder if we could just talk about the tactics a little bit, because it's been strange to me, even though it seems to have worked fairly well for Brown. One of the reasons that people like moderates is that I think they believe that moderates are nice people. They listen to all points of view. They're careful in what they say. And Brown has run this very nasty, personalized campaign with constant attacks on Warren as an individual. It seems to have worked, but it surprises me, and it seems to be slightly at odds with the image you'd normally want to project as a moderate. Equally, I've been a bit surprised by her tactics. Why hasn't she called him on this? Why hasn't she said, well, you know, Scott Brown's been a professional politician for 20 years. Professional politicians do this sort of thing, but I don't think we should have a campaign based on personality. Her strategy seems to have been to stand there and soak it up. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the best thing to do, but it's, again, it seems a little odd to me.
Yes, I had a one-on-one with her on Friday that I was going to run today or tomorrow, but that's probably not going to happen. It'll happen later in the week. But I asked her that question. You know, I asked her if it annoyed her that she's referred to as Granny Warren, the professor. I says, does that bug you when Scott Brown keeps calling you professor? She wouldn't go anywhere. She just wouldn't touch it. She'd say, well, if that's all they have, if that's the best they have, then I just let it ride. But she's trying to play it so cool. She's not...
Hey, Emily, can I say one other thing, too, that I've seen lately? I've been looking at their schedules for quite a while, and just yesterday was a perfect example. Scott Brown went from Springfield to Worcester to Lowell, had three events in three Democratic base areas, urban cities, you know, larger cities in Massachusetts. She had one event at 10 a.m. in Lynn, and that was it. This is the weekend before the final weekend of the election, and it's been like that for quite some time. And so you see a guy like Mayor Menino, who eventually came out and endorsed her, but always has been commenting about how Scott Brown outworks his opponents. And if they're coasting and counting on having this big turnout that's going to for Obama that's going to flow over them, you see the danger in that strategy in this latest poll finding.
Complacency is a terrible thing in politics. Sometimes it's a bigger enemy than your actual opponent. And if they believed when the poll started to break weeks back, if they believed that were true and they're playing it safe, in the end, in this state, you mentioned his crossover vote when he won the election. You know, their theory in most campaigns across the country is this will be a very different electorate than 2010. But the Republicans and the Democrats are having a debate about this. It's why you see so much complaining about the polls in every race, because they're running different simulations of who's going to vote. And I think that is the big question. How much correlation is there between the Obama vote and the Warren vote? And if the presidential race is closer here, Scott Brown's working hard. You know, sometimes voters who are undecided at the end, they look at that, the intensity, the effort. Does he want it or does she want it? That can matter.
So Scott Brown actually had kind of a cute comeback about the debate. He said, I'll be there. He says, that's why I have a truck. It has four-wheel drive. If Elizabeth Warren needs a ride, I'd be happy to pick her up. He's going to be here. That's good.
It's a good example of this image that he's projected, which is obviously invented. But again, the question is, why has Warren failed to puncture that image?
I don't know. I mean, I think tomorrow's debate, you're going to see something a little bit different from both of them. I mean, I think this whole thing about the Native American, I'm not going to ask John what he's going to ask him, but I think that has run its course. And I think even the whole thing of the asbestos charges, which she, you know, didn't help the people who were, she was the other side, the wrong side of the people who were in that asbestos case. I think both of those issues have kind of run their course. And
it's a question, though, of what the candidates decide will help them end to generate the turnout they're trying to get. And if their numbers are similar to these new Globe numbers, I think you'll see probably a little bit more energy in Ms. Warren, because she'll realize that she has to push harder for it. And you know, there's a part of this debate in the format where they get to question each other, which I think is a healthy thing. I think if people forget who the moderator of this debate was, that's the best debate possible. That means you had two candidates who were discussing the issues and having a good exchanges among and between themselves. And so I'm interested to the points what you say, that, you know, maybe the people have heard a lot about this in the prior debates and the advertising and the campaigning. But the candidates will get to make a choice about a lot of the subjects discussed in the middle of this debate. And we'll see.
Well, one thing we have to keep in mind is the national importance of this race. Because particularly if Romney were to win, it's so important for Democrats that they keep control of the Senate. And I would have thought that that's one point that they would really want to keep hammering home at this point.
Yeah, and that's, to me, the most fertile ground for her, is to say, okay, you know, you like the jacket, you like the truck, you know, you like the idea of him out in the MEMA bunker today, but here is how he's going to vote. And that was actually her most effective answer in the Springfield debate, the most recent encounter they had, when she basically went through his record and said he had one chance to vote for one for the Supreme Court, one chance to vote for this and that. And Scott Brown really did not have a strong comeback for that. So if you get beyond the personality, the actual voting record down there, the problem for her is that he's been there 2 years already, and people have seemed to develop a level of comfort with that he'll vote with the Democratic priorities here sometimes, he'll vote with the Republican priorities on other occasions.
So, John, you brought up the role of the moderator. I have to say, I've never seen an election cycle where the moderators got as much attention as they have this. Have you?
No, but I think that's mostly the evolution of technology and social media.
Maybe.
And the polarization of the country now plays out in the Twitterverse and on Facebook instantly. It used to be, you know, sure, people were watching at home. They would have these conversations or watching wherever they were watching, and they might, you know, complain about this or compliment that. And now people just pick up their device or they're sitting at a laptop watching the debate and they tweet out their criticism, and it's more reflexive and it's more partisan. It's the nature of the world. After the first presidential debate, I remember everybody on our panel at CNN said, wow, Romney won that debate and won it convincingly. And there were all these tweets in the Twitterverse saying, why are you people carrying Obama's water? And yeah. So there's a disconnect sometimes. You know, people, it's great that people have more vehicles, more avenues to be involved, to show their passions. Sometimes when they're showing their passion, it's sometimes a little bit disconnected from reality. But it comes with the territory. You do this for a living. We all do this for a living. You're going to speak publicly about these things in this environment with the instantaneous communication. They're going to kick the tires.
All right. I know you got to get going, John, because we've got a debate meeting happening upstairs, and I'll be joining you in a few minutes. So thanks for being with us, John King.
Pleasure to be here. Hope we get this done
tomorrow.
Everybody
will be tuning in tomorrow at 7, live right here on Channel 2. And the whole consortium, the Globe is part of it. Everybody's part of it. All right. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
So we're just going to move on and talk about a little presidential stuff here for a second. By the way, is this storm going to help President Obama? I mean, it's like, you know, he gets to be very presidential in a couple of hours, in a couple of days leading up to the next Tuesday.
I think it gives him three chances. The first is obviously to look presidential, to look in control, to look as though he's dealing with the situation competently. Downside of that is that if things go wrong and it looks as though they're dealing with the situation incompetently, then you're very vulnerable. But I assume that they have been watching FEMA like hawks as this storm develops. The other thing that I think helps him is that it reminds us that we do count on government in parts of our lives, that for all the talk about we didn't build it, and all the belief that entrepreneurs move everything forward, the reality is that at key moments in our lives, we do depend on government, and I think this is a reminder of that. And then the final thing, which I don't think would sway many people at this point, but perhaps there's just a bit of an opening to say, you know, climate really does matter, and Romney's move to rescind all action on climate change is something that perhaps could be thrown into the mix here from the president's point of view.
You know, you were talking about the gap with Romney and Obama here in Massachusetts. I'm not surprised at all to hear that I mean, it's unlikely that Obama could lose Massachusetts, but I mean, I feel like everywhere I go, I haven't heard anybody say they're voting for President Obama. Here we are in, you know, Democratic Massachusetts.
Right. Well, I just wrote something about the effect of the storm and basically said for right now, it's a wash, no pun intended, for both candidates. For the president, it gives him the opportunity to look presidential, to show and remind people, you know, why they may or may not think he's an effective leader. For Mitt Romney, that gives him actually a pretty unfettered chance in some swing states, although they just announced that he was going to cancel his events tonight and tomorrow
too?
Yeah, now they've announced tomorrow too. They said we want, you know, come together for a moment of national leadership. So that's some deference that he can show here. But it is for the president, the challenge is not so much the storm, it's the aftermath. You remember the problem for President Bush wasn't
exactly
Katrina
right.
or people, it was when they were on the roof. Yeah. And he was telling Mike Brown they did a heck of a job, that it was a real problem for him. And so that's why you see the president, he made this kind of ill-considered decision to go down to Florida last night anyway, but then booked it out of there first thing this morning, canceled his event, his appearance with Bill Clinton there, and came back to the White House. And so now he's got to make sure that he gets this right, because any fumble right now is so close to the election, it just has a chance to you know, make him look inept in his job.
You know, I was listening to John King over the weekend on Saturday morning, as a matter of fact, and he basically had the same analysis that Nate Silver from the 538 blog of the New York Times has, that saying that Obama has a 73.6% chance of winning. Really?
Well, I wrote about the split last week, potential split between the popular vote and the electoral vote, and when you look at that scenario, it's a lot stronger than you think. You know, the president has still been doing well to cobble together the vote, and that's what John is so good at.
Yeah,
you know,
he was
CNN,
so good,
when he's on that magic wall and he does the scenarios back and forth, you see how the numbers build up, and that's the last bit of salvation that the president and his campaign have in this whole thing, because the momentum has shifted towards Romney since that first debate. The polls have shifted towards Romney since that first debate. And the last piece of thing of strength that they have is saying that electorally we're strong and that get out the vote we're strong. And boy, they better be right. David Plouffe said one of us is bluffing, and in 7 days you'll know who it is. Well, that's very true.
Of course, back in Bush's time, FEMA was, before Katrina, a relatively obscure agency. Mm-hmm. And although that doesn't excuse his failings, or FEMA's failings over Katrina, it was sort of more understandable. If something goes wrong now, after post-Katrina, with all intention, then it really would be.
It was more obscure then. Hmm. I mean, it was the agency that always tell you to go buy duct tape. Now we're telling people to get D batteries and bottled water. It's like, what? You know, it's still, you know, I was laughing about the MEMA memo we all got on Friday about, you know, make sure your car is fueled, F-U-E-L-L-E-D. And
going back to the Electoral College versus the popular vote, sort of instinctively, I think, I don't think that we'd have another divergence. I don't know why I think that, because then I reflect on the fact that we had Gore winning the popular vote very handily in 2000. We came very close in 2004 to a popular vote Electoral College divergence. So maybe, you know, it's just that I have to shed the earlier part of my life and get used to thinking about this possible conflict between the two outcomes as normal.
Yeah, there's been four times already, but as the person I was interviewing last week pointed out, it's been close a lot more. And Graham, you just hit on a couple of them. You know, you go to 2004, and John Kerry is still famous to this day for saying 60,000 votes, a half a football stadium in Ohio, and, you know, we have a different outcome. So that's just, you know, as you see something that is just now this close and this polarized, it seems like it grows in all likelihood. The thing to me is, like, going forward from this, I've been asking this of the candidates and their campaign people throughout the election, especially in the Democratic side, what is going to happen if the president gets reelected in some ways? Because it seems like on the Republican side, there's now this great hope and belief that Mitt Romney can win. On the Democratic side, there's still the diehards who believe that President Obama can win reelection. But there's a lot of those people who are in between the two candidates and have been floating back and forth even this time. You know, what are they going to think if President Obama wins? Is it going to be like, oh man, you know, there's just not this energizing moment for the country like there would be if there was a new president coming in?
The same thing happened with George Bush.
Yeah.
Half the country was, you know, just despondent when he was reelected. So that's what it means. Although I've never heard the level of ugliness and vitriol and hate. I actually had a dinner guest at my house the other night and said, I hate the president. Who even thinks that way? But she's representative of, I think, a growing number of people who really feel that way.
Yeah. Well, of course, what the Obama campaign can't say is, but we all know, is that if he's reelected, it's a period of consolidation, that you're not going to get any radical new initiatives through. The Republicans will still have the House of Representatives. What it's about is continuing the establishment of the Affordable Care Act and comprehensive health insurance. It's about the economy continuing to improve at a very slow rate, but typically of a recession that follows a financial crisis, etc. But you can't go out and campaign and say, folks, the reality is if I'm reelected, nothing
much
is going
to happen.
It's
going to be more of the
same. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. This whole thing about jobs, like the president can make jobs happen. You can argue that the stimulus bills made jobs happen. You know, the bailout of Detroit made jobs happen. But the president just can't start whipping it up. You know, they can create government jobs, but they can't create private sector jobs.
Yeah, but I mean, and in that regard, Mitt Romney saying he's going to create 12 million jobs in his first term, 250,000 a month. Now, that's a huge number. But on the other hand, when you have a change in presidential leadership, you also have a sea change in attitudes and approaches towards business. And a lot of those things, you know, they would argue, takes money off the sidelines, out of the Wall Street and corporate coffers, and puts it back into job creation. So that's you know, the president doesn't create a job himself in terms of having somebody hand them their resume and then hire them and after interviewing them. But the president creates a climate in which the actors, the people who do the hiring, thing, get off the sidelines. And I think that's been their claim the whole way through.
I would have to disagree with that. I think that the stimulus did stop the downward slide in the economy. Mm-hmm. So I think that you can do something as a government to affect the economy. But I think the crucial things that will affect business investment will include what happens with the fiscal cliff, what happens in Europe. You know, the euro crisis has gone away. It's almost as though it went on so long we all got bored with it. And so that was the solution for us all to get bored with the euro crisis. But there are still people who say that in the medium term, you can't keep Greece in. There's still a problem with Spain, etc. So I think there are bigger things out there than a change in sentiment that would follow the election.
Talking to Graham Wilson, chair of the Political Science Department at Boston University, and Glenn Johnson, political editor for Boston.com. Actually, as it turns out, Mitt Romney is going to be campaigning later today in Iowa. And Iowa, of course, is one of the toss-up states. He's got about a 4% margin of victory there right now. Actually, Obama does.
Yeah.
Obama's ahead there.
Right.
He's slightly ahead in New Hampshire, Wisconsin. So those are all 4% states.
Right, yeah, he's going to continue through today
error.
And then shut it down tonight and into tomorrow. Yeah, Iowa, I was just out there last week, and the president has a slight lead there, but Romney's, you know, if he's not going to be in Virginia like he decided not to be on Sunday, and he's not going to be in New Hampshire like he decided against being on Tuesday, he's hitting Ohio, he's hitting Iowa, he's got Ann redeploying from New Hampshire today to Michigan. So, it's refocused where they're campaigning, because they've taken this certain swath of the United States off limits right now and just repurpose themselves to, you know, a different designated target.
One of the points that we touched on before, which just fascinates me, is whether this huge investment by the Obama campaign in sort of high-tech identify and get out the vote operations is going to have an impact or not. It's one area where they've outspent the Romney campaign. They've got many more field offices than the Romney campaign. Is it going to work? Glenn, I'm sort of wondering what your impression is when you get out there in the country.
I mean, they obviously feel it is. I mean, I went to this town, Newton, Iowa, this former home to Maytag. Maytag is shut. 1,800 people in a 15,000-person town lost their jobs. The president is campaigning there. He was there most recently in May as they've tried to have this wind energy industry build up there. They have both a wind blade manufacturer there, and they have a tower manufacturer for windmills. And so there's that shift there. And right when you get downtown into the Back to the Future town square of Newton, Iowa, with the courthouse in the middle, there's an Obama for America campaign office right there. And that has been their strategies, to put these things everywhere, to take a lot of faith, you know, confidence from that. And it's the same strategy that the Democrats have used here in Massachusetts, and it has worked of late, is to really work on the grassroots effort, to really identify people and to get them out to vote. And it started with early voting, and they believe it's going to continue on through Election Day.
This actual physical being in a state, does that really matter that much?
Well, local media coverage, I think it helps, you know, and you hear people, you know, people see the president there
he must like us if he's visiting my state.
Yeah.
I never really quite understood.
Well, it was funny. We were talking about it. I was up in Nashua on Saturday with the president, and afterwards I was riding back in the van with a couple of the reporters, and then there's 8,500 people there. Like, well, would some of the people just have been there if Mitt Romney were there too? I mean, it's a chance to see somebody that could be their national leader, or in this case, is their national leader. And so there's always a certain level of celebrity draw to these personal, in-person appearances for any of these candidates.
Yeah, I would have guessed the main payoff is there's free media.
But. Right.
Well, I mean, you're going to get the national coverage no matter what, because, you know, they're all over that. But I always wonder if people are really, you know, swayed by somebody's presence. I guess if you meet somebody,
right?
You know, the retail, you know, having somebody shake your hand is more meaningful.
And the president says something up there which definitely has an impact. You know, a lot of those people in southern New Hampshire or Massachusetts, transplants, 60% of the vote or so in New Hampshire comes from Manchester on south. So you put somebody in Nashua and they sit, and that person then slams Mitt Romney's record as a governor of Massachusetts. People there can relate and remember that. And so that is probably the most effective segment of the president's speech the other day. It wasn't talking talking about debt, deficit, or priorities. It was saying when Mitt Romney was governor, he raised all these taxes and fees or fees and that they didn't call taxes. And now he's out there running for president saying he's not going to raise taxes. You know, so there's an incongruity there that the president could expose to an audience that would understand what he means.
One of the things that we haven't talked about is your paper, the Globe documents today, are the frequent changes on policy that Mitt Romney has made during the election campaign. And yet I have a sense that this doesn't matter to the public. Now, flip-flopping has always been thought to be bad, and that's if your opponent can pin that on you.
Flip-flopping has a bad rap.
Right,
I've always said that, but it's like, what's wrong with changing your mind?
Hey, I have one friend who says, this is great. We've had too ideological a president in George Bush. If we have somebody who doesn't really believe in anything very much, then you should be happy. But for most people, flip-flopping has been thought to be a problem. And yet it doesn't, I don't get the feeling that it's really working very much for Obama. What's your impression as you go around?
Well, I'm surprised to the degree, I agree with you, that in the end, though, people are sitting there and when they go to the ballot box, they're deciding who they feel comfortable with and who they like. And as we see in the Brown race, it's not always policy-driven. It's personality-driven. And I think over time, I consider a campaign almost like a gestational period. People have a chance to grow comfortable with somebody over this 9-10-month period. And for Mitt Romney, people have had a chance over that time to digest the well-documented policy flip-flops, even from going from a primary described himself as severely conservative to now acting like he's the Massachusetts moderate that Newt Gingrich warned us against. And yet overarching that is this level of comfort people have developed with him as a person, with his family, with his wife's support for him. And that seems to me to have humanized him in a way that allows people to look past that. And, you know, you've seen that even as recently as 2004 with George Bush and John Kerry. It was just this better connection that Bush retained even after a four-year presidency that people were complaining about, and he ended up winning.
Yeah, the other issue that's completely disappeared, and rightfully so, but it has, and that's his religion. I mean, that was so prominent, especially during the primaries. I mean, there must have been 100 front page features about Mormonism and Romney's Mormonism in the Globe and the Times and all. It's just completely gone.
Yeah, there's going to be some interesting stories after. If Mitt Romney wins, there's going to be the whole, what do we get into here?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
People looking at the Mormon faith and how it may impact his presidency. I think another area that's hugely ripe for analysis is the way Tag Romney and the finance chair, Spencer Zwick, started this company that spun off of the 2008 campaign and has done venture capital raising for a lot of people that are connected to the Romney campaign. There's going to be these second looks at a lot of things that have already been looked at during the campaign, but once you realize that this person is your president, there's going to be a deeper look at them, and the religion would be one of them were he to win.
I just have to say on the overtime change point that the forecasting models always said this was going to be a very close race. And I'm not in that business. I'm not sure I really believe it, but I think it's my sort of professional obligation to point out that the forecasting models always said this is going to be extremely close. They came to slightly different conclusions, usually within their margin of error, but the one thing they agreed on was that it was always going to be close.
Well, all the last presidential races have been close. I mean, when you really think about it. Yeah. You know, 2004, 2008, they were all incredibly close. Talking to Graham Wilson from Boston University, Glenn Johnson, political editor for Boston.com. So over the weekend, the obligatory endorsements came out. The Boston Globe, of course, endorsed Elizabeth Warren. But on the presidential side, Romney got the Des Moines Register, that's Iowa. Obama got the Toledo Blade and Youngstown Vindicator. Those are both Ohio. I always wonder about these endorsements. I always have the sense that if you're really going off point, you know, off your comfort zone, like the Boston Globe endorsing Richard Tesei, I think that's meaningful, that's significant, because it's not in the norm for the Boston Globe, quite honestly. And I think that could have an impact, could have an effect, but otherwise, I'm not sure they do.
Well, that's what gave the potency to the Des Moines Register endorsement.
Yeah.
If you haven't endorsed a Republican since Richard Nixon, People are going to sit up and take notice in that state. It still has a very strong liberal democratic tradition to it. And so when the Des Moines Register comes out and says, okay, we were part of the crowd that helped set Barack Obama on his way in 2008, and now we're against him, people may not vote on the basis of it, but it certainly is an attention getter.
Yeah, you're right. 1972 was the last time they endorsed a Republican.
And you don't think that 6 pages in the New Yorker on why you should vote for Obama is quite the same.
No, do you?
No.
Yeah. Do you think those things sway people at all?
I would agree with Glenn that if it's unexpected, if it goes against the usual pattern, then it'll get some attention, it'll get some discussion, it'll perhaps push a few people who are thinking, well, I was maybe for Romney, but I'm not really sure, a bit further.
I thought the thing that was interesting, too, if you read the Globe endorsement, and I, just for the record, have nothing to do with that.
No, I know.
It's Peter Kanellis and his group over in the editorial page and op-ed pages that deal with that. But if you read that endorsement, it lays out a rationale for voting for her over Scott Brown that's interesting, that it suggests that he sees serving as a senator as a matter of political positioning, where should I be on this issue, and Elizabeth Warren is somebody who could use the bully pulpit of that office to address major national issues in a way that, say, Ted Kennedy did. And so for somebody that's been thinking, oh, do I like Scott Brown's pickup truck, or do I like Elizabeth Warren as a fighter and a consumer advocate, this lays out a rationale that's deeper and more detailed, and they can either agree with it or not agree with it, but there's somebody there offering a rationale for them to read and examine and consider.
Right. Glenn Johnson and Graham Wilson, just stand by for a second. We are, by the way, anticipating hearing from President Obama sometime, perhaps within the next 15, 20 minutes. We were told 12:45, that might go beyond that, but right now I've got Phil Burt from Orleans on the Cape on the phone, giving us a weather update. What's going on out there, Phil?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Well, it's we're in Orleans right now. Just went out to Nassau Beach. Winds across the Cape right now are basically between sustained around 20, 30, 40 miles an hour, gusting between 50 and 60 miles an hour. Hyannis just reported a 57-mile-an-hour gust just a few minutes ago.
What else? Where exactly are you? Can you see?
I am very close to Nauset Beach right now. Just went out there. I actually had to come back in a little bit. A lot of people down there right now just kind of checking out the surf. Very large waves. No significant tidal surge right now. Typical kind of minor coastal flooding at this high tide. I think it'll be the late evening one that'll be the bigger concern out here, but definitely very large waves.
Phil, what about boats? I heard this morning people still had their boats in the water, and they were just like sort of fastening down, or there was a bunch of boats still on moorings. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen that, and I've actually had some pictures.
I don't understand that, by the way. If I had a boat, it would not be on its mooring right now.
Yeah, I know. We actually were in a couple. We've seen a couple in some of the harbors around here. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there was a lot of warnings, so... can't speak for those folks, but there's definitely still boats in some of the harbors. But I think, a lot of people did try and get stuff out. Of course, it's kind of late in the season down here, too, so a lot of that stuff has already been pulled in.
What about rain itself? Right now, we're sort of in a lull. We've got a little wind here outside the studios at WGBH in Alston, but really no rain.
I think most of the rain will really end up on the far western side of the storm, definitely western parts of New England. Here, for like even up to Boston, down here to the Cape, I don't think there'll be all that much rain, especially here on the Cape. It is raining here very lightly right now. We'll get some showers every once in a while, probably a tropical downpour or something like that. But the big story is going to be the wind and the surge, the midday tide, and then again, the late evening tides will be the big concerns. And of course, power outages and trees down as winds continue to increase here over the next couple hours.
There was already a tragedy, I'm sure, as you heard, with the USS Bounty, which is off the coast of North Carolina. And, that's that beautiful tall ship. I'm sure they had the sails down, but some wave swept 14 people overboard, and I guess two are still missing. So,
Saw that on various outlets this morning.
Think they would have tried to hightail it out of there, but I guess they really can't. I don't know if that ship has any power other than sail. Or not.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it'll be interesting to hear when the stories come out. That's exactly, why they were located where they were, when they were.
Really too bad. All right, Phil Burt, thanks for that update from Orleans.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Great, thank you.
Back to the studio, I've got Graham Wilson from Boston University and Glenn Johnson from, he's political editor for Boston.com. I have the sense, though, that people are a little relieved today that not all the talk is just the rhetoric from the campaigns. How many people have said to you in recent days, I just can't wait for it to be over?
I totally agree with you. I find that myself, I've been thinking a little bit about what happens after the election, perhaps because I'm really campaigned out. And first of all, if Obama were to get back, what would happen with the fiscal cliff? And there would be some really interesting politics over the next few months. So I assume that if Romney wins, then it's all put on hold. They say he's going to need time, and it's all extended until the end of March.
But the cliff is going to happen no matter what.
Well,
that sequestration is going to kick in, or can they change that?
They could change that, and I think that they are. I don't think anybody really wants to deal with it in that amount of time anyway, so I think that you could round up the votes in Congress to say new president deserves time to think about this, kick it out to the end of March or possibly even April. On the other hand, if Romney wins, then I think one of the interesting questions, assuming that the Democrats retain the Senate, which most people seem to be assuming at present, is how hard will the Democrats fight to retain the key features of the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, the Republicans from the outset of the Obama presidency have been pretty clear what their strategy has been, and that's been to block what the president has tried to do. I mean, for the first 2 years, they had a Democratic, all-Democratic Congress, so they could get things through by hook and crook, like the Affordable Care Act. But Mitch McConnell made his declaration early on, and they pretty much lived up to it. The question is, if Mitt Romney becomes the president, the Republicans retain the House, but the Democrats retain the Senate, do they fight in the same way? And the history shows that quite often they don't.
Yes,
that the Republicans remain unified. They have this unity of purpose. In this case, it's been to get Barack Obama defeated. But on the other hand, the Democrats have this feeling, this calling of a higher angel, that they should do what's in the best interest of the country. And so quite often you see the opposition crumble in that way, the unity not stick the way it would in a Republican campaign and a Republican Congress. And so, you know, that will be, you know, is there that kind of courage? Does the partisanship get even more rancorous as we go forward, or is there a Democratic effort to try and acquiesce and move things along? You know, we saw that when George Bush won an election that many Democrats felt he didn't win, and you know, I would think history would suggest that would happen again, where Mitt Romney reelected.
My money also would be on the Democrats crumbling, and we could even go back to the Reagan years and make the argument that that's what happened on a number of key votes there as well.
By the way, has either of you done any kind of statistical analysis on one-term presidents? It seems like it's cyclical, the same way Republicans, Democrats. I mean, it's almost dead even in the history of the presidency, Democrats, Republicans. And then it seems like every 18, you know, 16, 20 years, there's a one-term president, last being George Bush 1, before that Carter. So is that pretty, you know?
I haven't looked at it numerically. I just get the feeling, though, now that the way this country is cleaved, the leash is very short. Barack Obama came into office with some of the worst financial conditions there's ever been in the country, except for the 1930s, and has been given less than 4 years to fix them. Basically, Romney's candidacy was declared, you know, informally. Three years left, maybe 2 years left in his campaign, within his term, and ever since then, he's been arguing the president hasn't improved things fast enough. And so, you know, if Mitt Romney gets in there and people feel like after a while, geez, you know, we gave up on Obama too soon, or, you know, we see some of these policy flip-flops, you know, come to life in a way that a lot of voters don't like, you know, is he going to have an equally short leash as a president? Because with an electorate this evenly divided, you know, that 5 or 6% in the middle can go back and forth so easily that nobody can really claim a mandate.
Of course, the opposite point of view, which is probably the one I would take. Here, I'm going to sound a bit like
I'm going to sound a bit like a candidate.
I'm an optimist about the United States of America.
Yes.
I really think that within 4 years, we are going to see a recovery.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And,
definitely.
Of course, what that might mean, as you could argue it meant for Clinton, is that you inherit the beginnings of a recovery, as right. he did from George H.W. Bush, and then you get reelected.
Yeah. And that would be the thing that would probably, you know, put a knife in President Obama's heart if he felt that the economy – if you look at – they have a very strong and powerful graphic talking about job creation and all the trends. All the trend lines show bottoming out, you know, right after he gets in office and then slow recovery. The pace of it hasn't been fast enough, you know, in Mitt Romney's eyes. But there's been sort of an undeniable trend in the reduction in the unemployment rate, in job creation in some ways. And it would, wouldn't it just be the great thing for him to have this accelerate, take root in the first term of a Mitt Romney presidency and him get a second term that Obama didn't get because that pace wasn't fast enough and the trend line wasn't that obvious to people.
Yeah. Just going back to the Affordable Care Act, I think we again return to the national importance of the Massachusetts Senate race because I think that if Warren were to win and be in the Senate and could be a Northeastern Democrat who can afford to take a strong position in total defense of the Affordable Care Act, it makes a difference. And if Scott Brown, who had been associated with a challenge to the Affordable Care Act and the 2010 victory, were defeated, that would send a message. If she loses, then the opposite works.
I do think that that's one area where I think you'd see the Democrats unlikely to crumble.
We're going to go now to the White House. President Obama's address to the nation about Hurricane Sandy.
The Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Health, Homeland Security, and the Department of Health and Human Services. Obviously, everybody is aware at this point that this is going to be a big and powerful storm. And all across the eastern seaboard, I think everybody is taking the appropriate preparations. I've spoken to all the governors in all these states. They have issued emergency declarations. Those have been turned around quickly here in the White House. We have pre-positioned assets so that FEMA personnel are working closely with state and local governments. We're making sure that food and water and emergency generation is available for those communities that are going to be hardest hit. We anticipate that the center of the storm is going to hit landfall sometime this evening. But because of the nature of this storm, we are certain that this is going to be a slow-moving process through a wide swath of the country, and millions of people are going to be affected. So the most important message that I have for the public right now is please listen to what your state and local officials are saying. When they tell you to evacuate, you need to evacuate. Do not delay. Don't pause. Don't question the instructions that are being given, because this is a serious storm, and it could potentially have fatal consequences if people haven't acted quickly. The good news is that the governors and local officials, I think, have had a few days of preparation. There's been extraordinarily close coordination between state, federal, and local governments. And so we're confident that the assets are pre-positioned for an effective response in the aftermath of the storm. But keep in mind that for folks who are not following instructions, if you are not evacuating when you've been asked to evacuate, you're putting first responders at danger. We're going to have search and rescue teams in and around multiple states all at the same time. And although we've got Coast Guard and the Department of Defense all positioned, if the public's not following instructions, that makes it more dangerous for people, and it means that we could have fatalities that could have been avoided. Transportation is going to be tied up for a long time, and probably the most significant impact for a lot of people, in addition to flooding, is going to be getting power back on. We anticipate that there are going to be a lot of trees down, a lot of water, and despite the fact that the power companies are working very closely with their various state officials and local officials to make sure that they are bringing in as many assets as possible and getting those ready in preparation for the storm, the fact is that a lot of these emergency crews are not going to be able to get into position to start restoring power until some of these winds have died down. And because of the nature of this storm, that may make that may take several days. So the public should anticipate that there's going to be a lot of power outages, and it may take time for that power to get back on. The same is true with transportation. There are going to be a lot of backlogs. And even after the storm has cleared, it's going to take a considerable amount of time for airlines, subways, trains, and so forth, potentially to get back on schedule, depending on the amount of damage that has occurred. Let me summarize just by saying that I'm extraordinarily grateful for the cooperation of our state and local officials. The conversations that I've had with all the governors indicate that at this point there are no unmet needs. I think everybody is taking this very seriously. We've got pre-positioned all the resources that we need, but right now the key is to make sure that the public is following instructions. For those of you who still need additional information about how to respond, you can go to ready.gov. That's ready.gov. And that website should provide you with all the information that your family needs in terms of how you can prepare for this storm. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all the people who are potentially affected. We are extraordinarily grateful for our first responders because they're going to be working 24/7 around the clock nonstop. I want to make sure that our thoughts and prayers go out to all those who may end up be dealing with a very difficult situation over the next several days. Last point I'll make, though, this is going to be a big storm. It's going to be a difficult storm. The great thing about America is when we go through tough times like this, we all pull together. We look out for our friends. We look out for our neighbors. We set aside whatever issues we may have otherwise to make sure that we respond appropriately with swiftness. And that's exactly what I anticipate is going to happen here. So I want to thank all the federal teams, state and local teams that are in place. I'm confident that we're ready. But I think the public needs to prepare for the fact that this is going to take a long time for us to clean up. The good news is we will clean up and we will get through this.
What about the impact on the election, sir?
We're listening to the President of the United States speaking from the White House. He was about to take a couple questions from reporters there. I mean, so speaking here in the studio with Glenn Johnson from Boston.com and Graham Wilson, chair of the Political Science Department at Boston University. Not to politicize this moment, but this is the President of the United States who has the opportunity to address the nation at a very critical time. This storm is going to affect 60 million people. You know, you're not going to be turning to Mitt Romney at this point to see what he can do, what the government can do for us at this point. So
in one role, he's the logistical person, you know, saying we've got things pre-positioned. And in another role, he's the inspirational leader for the country. And he's saying, you know, these things test us, but we get through them. That's the bully pulpit that he has right now. And how he exercises it over the next couple of days will, you know, have some impact on the outcome of this election.
As I listened to it, I thought that it's both puzzling, but also in a way quite admirable, that what he did was pretty low-key, mm-hmm. pretty technical. Yeah. Only at the very end did you get a hint of the soaring rhetoric that right. if it was Ronald Reagan would have been more or less the whole broadcast.
Our hearts go out to those who might be affected.
Right, and first responders, etc. Yeah. So good for him thinking about the crisis, but just talking politics, again, it's interesting that he doesn't take the opportunity to really make that part of it the center.
Well, let's hope, gratefully didn't. All right, Graham Wilson and Glenn Johnson, thanks so much for being with us for our politics as usual. All right, we're going to be checking in later on with weather down in the Cape. We already did that once, but we'll check in again later. Meanwhile, Kara Miller is in Studio 3.
Hey, Emily. So we're going to continue the political conversation with Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer. She's been in the trenches of a swing state, in a swing county, a swing state, and it's a state that's being hit by Hurricane Sandy, too. We're going to talk to her about how a high-stakes election plays out in a region where the race is still very much up for grabs.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in Virginia. All mm-hmm. right, Kara Miller, I'm Emily Rooney.
And I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio.